As a physician, it's been very interesting for me to watch the way medicine has changed within the state over the last 15 years or so. One such change is a very positive one, and this is the work we are doing with autism and other neurodevelopmental disorders. Today, here to speak with us, we have Dr. Matthew Siegel, who is the director of the Developmental Disorders Program of Maine Behavioral Healthcare. This program is the only of its kind in Maine that serves youth ages 5 to 21 who have mental illnesses and neurodevelopmental disorders, such as autism. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I think our conversation began when you and I met at 317 Maine, and I mentioned to you that it was very interesting to me that you were doing this type of work, in part because I have seen in my practice, and I know most family doctors have, quite an increase in children and adults who are impacted by autism, autism spectrum disorder, other neurodevelopmental challenges. So I think it's really great that you're doing this sort of work. How did you get interested in it yourself?
When I was in medical school, I encountered a person with autism and a young person, and I just found myself endlessly interested in trying to understand who this person was. They had a lot of difficulty communicating, and since I gravitated to psychiatry and trying to, you know, psychiatry is about trying to understand what is happening in, with people and their thoughts and emotions and relationships, and so I thought this was kind of the biggest challenge would be to try to understand that with someone whose brain is working in a different way and who has difficulty communicating. And so I got very interested in medical school and began working with children who have developmental disabilities. And I then did my training at Bradley Hospital in Rhode Island, which has a very extensive program for children with developmental disorders, including a hospital program, an outpatient program, residential programs, and it really serves the whole state and is a home for those families who have children with these challenges, and became really enamored with the idea of trying to provide what these families and children need, and so that's what drew me in.
When I was talking earlier about how medicine in Maine has shifted, I think it's medicine really everywhere. Mm-hmm. Medicine everywhere has shifted. I think psychiatry has been quite a fascinating evolution over mm-hmm. time. It used to be more therapy-oriented, mm-hmm. and then it's become very medical. And now it seems to me what you're doing mm-hmm. is quite a combination of these things.
That is the case. That's part of what drew me into it is I think children who have developmental disabilities tend to either have behavioral challenges or sometimes they themselves have the same problems or mental health challenges that the rest of us can have, such as anxiety or depression or psychosis or other things. And they, in fact, have them at higher rates than your typical child population. And so it's a real nexus of both the medical and biological and the psychological or psychiatric. And so that's really what drew me to working with these children. It's an enormous challenge. The question of how do you detect and then treat and help a child who might have autism and severe anxiety is a real challenge, but one that is really fascinating to try to work on and try to help.
Yeah, you've taken on a big thing, a big nut to try to crack here, because it's not just about an individual patient. It's about an individual patient and their family and their school system and their community. So what you're doing with them has really far-reaching implications and also must require quite a lot of teamwork.
Yes. So I'm glad you asked. If you'll let me tell you a little bit about what we're doing. So one cannot do this as an individual provider, be they a speech pathologist or psychiatrist or other. But it really, autism and other developmental disabilities are a whole body, whole system challenge and present you know, needs in all kinds of areas, including communication, behavioral functioning, family functioning, et cetera. And so I think what I learned in my work and training in Rhode Island is you really need systems of care that are specialized to these children and families to support them. And so what drew me to Maine was the opportunity through Spring Harbor Hospital and Maine Behavioral Health Care to develop systems of care to try to serve these children as best we could. And so we, it's very exciting, and I think it's a nice Maine story that against maybe all odds, in a state that is fairly rural and has a, you know, not necessarily a great deal of resources, we've actually developed and are developing one of the leading systems, I think, in the country for the care of these children, which is that we have a very specialized hospital unit at Spring Harbor Hospital, where we only admit children who have both a developmental disability and a behavioral or mental health challenge. And there are only, this is a very unique thing, there are only 10 units like this in the entire country. And they're mostly at major medical centers, University of Pittsburgh, places like that. But it's a nice main story that the reason there's one in Maine is that children with these challenges 10 years ago were being sent out of state regularly because they couldn't get the treatment here. And I think the parents advocated with the governor at that time that we needed a resource here in Maine. And so Spring Harbor was asked to do this, and they did. And that's what drew me here, was to help develop that program. And what we've found over time is that it's wonderful to have a hospital unit that can do this work. In addition, we need, you know, we need other levels of care in addition to the hospital. And so a very exciting development for us as a system, and for me as someone dedicated to this group of people, is this fall we will be opening a new center called the Center for Autism and Developmental Disorders in South Portland, Maine, about 5 minutes from Spring Harbor Hospital. And that center will include an outpatient clinic to serve children who don't need to be in the hospital, and will also include a day program or a day treatment program for kids who need more intensive services. And so our focus there is really to try to provide most of what a family needs under one roof. You know, we do this in other areas of medicine. When you have, you know, cancer or diabetes or something, you don't travel all around going to different doctors. You usually go to a center that provides you what you need. These children need multiple services: speech, occupational therapy, behavioral help, psychiatry, social work, case management. And unfortunately, right now, we ask these families who already are so stretched to visit all those providers separately. And so part of our vision is to bring it under one roof, and we're very fortunate that we're going to be able to do this. And we're partly able to do it because we received a very nice gift from the Glickman family of Maine, and also from the Harold Alphon Foundation.
Well, people who listen to the radio show regularly will know that we had Greg Powell on to talk about the Alphon Foundation, and they are doing great work within the state. So it's wonderful to hear, you know, directly from somebody who's benefiting. For people who don't necessarily know what autism is or know what the definition of a neurodevelopmental disorder is, explain that to us.
Okay. So a neurodevelopmental disorder is what we think of as a variation in how someone's brain develops, and which may lead to something like autism or having intellectual disability for an unknown reason. And perhaps the thing that people are most familiar with would be autism. And so what autism is right now is described as a set of characteristics that someone has. And the main features of it are delays and challenges in social communication. And that can vary from someone who doesn't speak at all to someone who can talk quite a bit and in fact is verbose, but has challenges with understanding very subtle social interactions, and so may talk your ear off whether you're interested or not. And may not be able to detect whether you're interested, particularly in what they're saying. So there's the area of social communication, and then there's the area in the other area in autism is called restricted and repetitive interests or behaviors. And this can vary from having very restricted interests in particular topics. So the person might be talking your ear off about Egyptology, or can vary to individuals who have very restricted patterns of behavior where they're doing things repetitively. We think because it's self-stimulatory or soothing in some ways. This might be someone who's rocking repetitively or maybe waving their hand in front of their eyes to change the light patterns, and that this is stimulatory in a way that might be pleasurable or soothing for them, although also could indicate distress. But the short answer is autism is challenges in those two areas, social communication and restricted and repetitive behaviors. And what makes it somewhat challenging to understand is that people can be on such a range or spectrum in these two areas. The other challenge is that, as I described, autism is a set of characteristics that we recognize. So it's a clinical diagnosis. We don't, as of yet, have a lab test or something to say, yes, you have autism, or no, you don't. So that is part of the challenge. And maybe that brings me to the other piece I didn't describe of our program, which is we also have taken on, and in a major way, doing clinical research in our program, because we found that our initial goal was to do excellent clinical care, but we found that really to do that, there were so many questions that we wanted to try to be a part of answering. And so we developed a whole clinical research program that we're doing through Spring Harbor and Maine Medical Center, both with children who are in our hospital unit and then other children in the community.
What types of questions are you trying to answer?
So our biggest project is we formed a collaborative of all the specialized units in the country, these 10 units that I referred to that serve this population, hospital population, because through that collaboration, we have about 1,000 children a year with autism going through those units, which in the autism research world is a large number. And we thought, well, there's an opportunity to try to learn some things about this population. And what we have in particular in these units are children who are more severely affected on average by autism. And in the literature, in research studies, most research in autism, it turns out, is actually with individuals who are less severely affected. And there's a number of reasons for that, probably. So we have access to the population that's understudied. So to answer your question, some of the things we're looking at is how do you detect mental health challenges in individuals with autism? So how would you diagnose anxiety in a person who has autism? That's one area of focus for us. Another is we're looking at what are the treatment outcomes of doing intensive treatment like we do. So we're studying our own and other programs to look at, you know, how do children do, what helps them more or less. Probably the biggest research question we're pursuing with this large collaboration is we're trying to understand the different subtypes of autism. So I described the spectrum to you, and really what most people think is that, you know, there's no one autism, but rather there's probably 100 or 1,000 different autisms. And the only way to make progress in that is to try to very carefully detail what you're seeing and what the person's behaviors are and how they present, which is called phenotyping, and then take their blood or saliva with permission, and then do genotyping, look at their gene sequences, and then try to see if you can relate those two things. And so we can say, okay, well, this child has kind of this type of autism, and it tends to come with these kind of genetic changes and these kind of behaviors and et cetera. And so by collecting a large number of kids across this network, we can start to do that. And really, I would phrase it as we are one of a number of groups who are doing this around the country and the world, and so we're trying to play a part in that, of contributing the more severely affected kids to that analysis.
There has been a lot of fear and anxiety and frustration, I think, since we've seen either we're diagnosing people more effectively with autism, or we have more people who actually are coming into the world with autism, or probably there's a combination of those two things. We've blamed autism and autism spectrum on everything from vaccines to, I think, poor mothering to infection to, and you're talking about genetics now. We don't know. What we don't think is true at this point is we don't think it's caused by something like the MMR vaccine. We don't think it was the thimerosal, the mercury preservative in the MMR vaccine, because initial studies that were put out there, they were actually found to be incorrect. And I think that information was retracted in The Lancet, which is the medical journal in England. But there's still a lot of fear because we still don't know, and we still see all these kids. And it seems like more and more of us, whether we're doctors or not, are seeing these children and even adults in the community who have autism spectrum issues.
Yeah, so it's, I think it's unfortunately one of the great mysteries of our time is what causes autism, and is there an increase in the number of individuals who have autism? And the people who figure that out, undoubtedly that will be an automatic Nobel Prize, because it really is one of the great mysteries. And so, you know, we know some things, as you said. We know it appears that some things don't cause autism, such as the initial information that came out about the MMR vaccine, which has been shown repeatedly to not be the case. And some things we do know, but we only know them as associations, meaning we can't prove that they're causal. So we know that advanced parent age, both mother and father age at conception, is associated with a higher risk of autism. We know genetics is involved to some degree because the risk, if you have one child with autism, then the risk of having another is much higher than if you've never had a child with autism. And also specific genetic changes have been can be identified in about 25% of children with autism currently. And that number keeps going up every year slowly. There's other things that have been associated. It appears that low intake of folic acid has a small risk associated with it. Obesity during pregnancy is a small risk associated with it, and a number of other things. However, they all have small risks associated with them, and nothing has really come forward as being, you know, the leading thing. And so it may be the case that either we haven't found it, or it may be that autism can be caused by a number of different things or a combination of things. And that the story, unfortunately, is more complex than we would wish that it is. And so we have to keep working at unraveling it. And I think some of the challenge, which I think you referred to, is that anytime we have an area in medicine or in life where we don't where we don't understand it well, what causes it, and it creates a lot of need, then, you know, there's a lot of searching about for answers, and that's understandable. But just like in, say, something like fibromyalgia, which we don't understand well, and we search for lots of answers for, and unfortunately, it also brings the risk of people putting forward very, very probably unlikely theories, and then treatments based on those theories that may or may not have any evidence or validity behind them, which can then develop some concerning situations.
For individuals who are listening who don't have family members with autism, but might be exposed to somebody who has autism, say a child in school or say just a member of the community, what are some things that we can do to be helpful?
I think what some parents tell me is just trying to have an understanding that if a child is having a hard time in Walmart or at the grocery store or such, that, you know, I think many of us are the first thought might be, oh, there's some bad parenting involved or other, but that, you know, there are quite a, you know, there's quite a number of children who there may be another reason. And so just, I guess, trying to be understanding to what the situation is that's going on. You know, you may or may not know what's going on with that child, but at least considering that there could be another reason that a child is struggling, and trying to be understanding with that. I think that also what I hear from parents is extending that is they would like to have settings that understand their children better. So we can ask a stranger in a store to just try to be somewhat understanding, but in settings like medical settings or educational settings, really there we should be well aware of what's going on and providing, you know, an appropriate environment. And so I think that's part of what we're particularly excited about with developing our new outpatient center is this is going to be a place where one of our goals is for families really to feel at home and to feel like these people get it. And, you know, if my child's having a meltdown in the waiting room, that's actually expected and not a problem for us or for them. And in fact, that's why they're there, partly is for us to help them. And so that vision of providing a home for people and families who are already dealing with some very challenging situations is, I think, part of what we're really excited about. Other things that people can do, I think it's helpful just that the awareness has gone up around autism and other developmental disabilities. People can also donate or volunteer with organizations, whether you're supporting research, which is very important, or other volunteer organizations such as the Autism Society of Maine, which is a wonderful organization and holds walks and other things. So those are other ways to be involved.
It is a very stressful situation for families. I have much experience in my medical practice with families, and, you know, parents will often have to stop working to care for a child or greatly reduce their work hours, really dramatically change the way that they interact within the family. It impacts not just the child with autism, but it impacts other siblings who don't have autism but don't maybe get quite as much attention as they once did. As you said, there's a lot of different appointments people have to go to. So it's a financial burden, it's a social burden. It really, I think, speaks to this greater need for compassion, as you said. I mean, it's not really, autism is a funny, funny thing because you can't tell necessarily by looking at somebody who has autism that they have this issue. Mm-hmm. So it's very easy to judge. And if you can take a step back and realize that it's not as straightforward as all of that. I'm really glad that you're doing this work because I was thinking about, before you came on the show, I was thinking about the time I spent as a medical student at Maine Medical Center and some of the patients we saw in the acute psychiatry intake and how many of them were families and many of them were extremely stressed and they had already been to an emergency facility outside the state and traveling back and forth to try to see their child. And I think the more that you can create this sort of normalized situation, the better off really all families and the community is going to be because, you know, it's not a long-term solution to ship our people elsewhere. You know, they're all going to eventually end up back in our community. So we're better off trying to understand this now and work with them now.
Right. And I think, you know, it takes a great deal to do that, and so, you know, it's about developing the systems of care that we can, even in a smaller state like Maine, and to do that, we need the support of the population, the legislature. Most of these children and families are utilizing Medicaid, and a portion of that is paid for by the state, and so having the support of people to provide that care is a key piece of what we do and what these families need.
Well, this brings up lots of different questions that I have. I know that people who are listening will be interested in how they can learn more about the program that you have through Maine Behavioral Healthcare. Dr. Siegel, what's the best way for people to get this information?
I would say to look at our website. which I believe is www.springharbor.org. There's also a Maine Behavioral Healthcare website as well. And there you can see information about our current programs, and soon we will be building out the webpage for this new center that we're developing and opening in late fall of 2014. And so there they'll be able to see how to access the resources at that new center.
Well, I'm really excited about the work that you're doing, and I give you a lot of credit for knowing that this is the path you wanted to follow when you were a medical student, because it's important that we do things that we feel passionate about. That's the only way that we'll be able to make changes. So I appreciate your doing that. We've been speaking with Dr. Matthew Siegel, the director of the Developmental Disorders Program of Maine Behavioral Healthcare. I can't wait for your new center to open, and thanks so much.
Thank you. You're welcome.